Thank you, David. I'd like to introduce Dr. David Wareham, who is a senior clinical lecturer from Queen Mary College in London, but also a practicing clinical microbiologist at Barts and London Hospital. He's going to talk about treatment options, something we all face from time to time as clinical microbiologists, that very resistant carbapenemase producer. What are we going to treat it with? David's going to give us an update. David.
Thank you, Peter. Okay, well, I mean, really, whatever branch of medicine you're in, you're going to be confronted with trying to treat resistant gram-negative infections. They cause an enormous range of things, from very minor infections to bacteremia, sepsis, intra-abdominal infections, and even meningitis. And there's a whole range of species here. So to cover this in 20 minutes is quite difficult, but I'll try and put them as what I see are the problem areas where we need some guidance and advice on how to treat these things. So I would split them into cephalosporin-resistant and ESBL-producing Enterobacteriaceae, so E. coli and Klebsiella, maybe with CTXM-1415 enzymes, other ESBL variants. Some of these are part of virulent and epidemic clones like ST131 or Klebsiella pneumoniae ST258 we've already heard about. The problem of AMPC producers, Enterobacter, Citrobacter serratias. And then we have carbapenemase producers, E. coli's and Klebsiellas with KPC, OXA48 or NDM, with or without ESBLs, the non-fermenters, Pseudomonas and Acinetobacter with IMP and VIM. And then we have the organisms which are resistant to everything. You can call them XDR or pan-drug resistant, whatever you like. Again, usually Pseudomonas or Acinetobacter. So I think the first thing to tackle is how do we treat ESBL producers? So the dogma has been that if for serine infections, we should use carbapenems. But do you always have to use carbapenems if they're susceptible to something else, if they're susceptible to some cephalosporins or inhibitor combinations or quinolones? Well, I can refer you to this recent systematic review, which is in in this month's JSC, of 21 studies that found that, yes, if you really have a bacteremia with an ESBL producer, carbapenems are better. For empirical treatment, carbapenems are better than perhaps quinolones or aminoglycosides, but the inhibitors, the jury is still out. For empirical treatment, the inhibitors still seem to have some chance of being useful in empirical treatment of an ESBL infection. So can we trust this analysis? Well, it's very heterogeneous. These studies are done in different regions of the world where we have different complements of ESBLs, which may be more or less have different the inhibitors maybe have different activity against them, and differing MICs and dosing regimens have been used. So I would say we've not perhaps heard the end of the inhibitor story and whether you can use these in treating ESBLs. But this is important because if we rely on carbapenems, then we will overuse them. We all know that if we want to save lives, we have to give people antibiotics early and quickly. But then we also need to de-escalate when we can. And now meropenem is generic, it removes a lot of the financial considerations, and we use it earlier and earlier. So can we use anything else? What else is available? This is one of David's papers that he looked at the other options, perhaps for less severe infections. Unfortunately, if you look at quinolones, aminoglycosides, nitrofurin, taurine, trimethoprim, then the ESBL producers are usually resistant to these as well, so the options are limited. What about this? T-morcillin for ESBLs. So this has been proposed. It's stable to most ESBLs and to AMPC, no activity against Pseudomonas or gram-positives. And it's pretty active against a wide range of ESBL producers, regardless of the ESBLs that they may carry. And this study, I think, nearly 90% of them are susceptible at less than 16 milligrams per liter. And David has also looked at this and against UK isolates, and it's pretty active. Any clinical data on this? Yes. So this is a group. It's an observational study looking at its use versus in bloodstream infection, in urinary tract infections, and a few cases of VAP. And they reported some good clinical efficacy, using T-morcillin. No difference if there are AMPCs in there as well. And it's this interesting thing to remember that the dosing, okay, if you give a higher dose, this is something I'll talk about, I think should be, go through the talk, the correct dosing of these drugs is very important to get a good clinical outcome. Okay, what about, we move on to the carbapenemase producers. What's actually active against these? Again, this is another one of David's studies looking at what can we use against carbapenemase producers. So this is just a scatter of the of what's of the MICs and what might be useful. So I mean things like chloramphenicol, colistin, tigecycline, nitrofurantoin, timosylin. The main clustering is around colistin and tigecycline. So these are probably the things you're going to turn to first of all to try and treat these organisms. But going back to dosing, can we not just use carbapenems? Okay, they've got carbapenemases, but maybe we can use carbapenems if we dose them correctly. And this is experience that they've had in Greece, where they have a lot of carbapenemases, VIMP and IMP, KPC. And if the best parameter is to keep the dose of the drug at 50% at above the MIC for 50% of the time, which is what you want to do with beta-lactams, then if the MIC is less than or equal to 4 and you give high doses of meropenem as a prolonged infusion, you may be able to achieve this here. And a lot of these KPC producers have quite low MICs to meropenem, as you can see in these e-tests here. So I think they are using this in countries where they have very high prevalence of KPC and nothing else to use, but the dosing and the treatment regimen is critical if you're going to get a good outcome with using this strategy. A few rules if you go to carbapenemases. You know, is there anything that we might think might be useful for some of these clones that we see, such as SC258, KPC producer? Well, they're usually susceptible to myoglycosides, as the 16S methylases are rare in these strains. Some IMP and VIM producers may be sensitive to aztreonam, but usually they have a co-resident ESBL, so they will not be. Likewise, OXA48 producers may be susceptible to cephalosporins, but again, they usually have a co-resident ESBL, so they will not be. And most Enterobacter and Acinetobacter are called sensitive to tigecycline, and almost all are sensitive to polymyxins. So basically, you're left with this thing at the bottom. Do we use tigecycline or do we use colistin against these carbapenemase producers? So, tigecycline. So, okay, this has good activity in vitro against most carbapenem-resistant enterobacteria and Acinetobacters, but it's a bacteriostatic drug, and you get very low serum levels in the blood. We used a lot of tigecycline to treat Acinetobacter in the past few years, and we found that, okay, you get some response, but we get recurrent episodes of bacteremia when we use it and development of frank resistance in quite a few cases, and that's due to within about 8 days, just mutation of the efflux pumps, which can exclude tigecycline, and you get resistance in this Acinetobacter here with an MIC from 0.5 going to 16 in 8 days, and frank resistance to tigecycline. And this is seen in other species as well, in Enterobacter, Klebsiella, in Serratia. The same homologous pumps which can extrude tigecycline from the cell can be and mutate very readily, and you get failure of the drug. And this has, been taken up in systematic reviews. There are two now that say that tigecycline is certainly in severe infections is quite should not perhaps be used. And if you look at some of the clinical, the microbiological eradication of pathogens in these infections, then against the gram negatives, it's pretty poor. So that leaves us with colistin. And clearly, people are very interested in trying to use colistin. So you can see the number of publications that have been on this and also the rise of resistance when it's being used. So colistin, if we're going to use colistin, brings a few issues, and I list them here. First of all, how do we do the susceptibility testing for it? Is it effective? Is it safe? And how should we give it? So, how do we do susceptibility testing? I don't think this is straightforward. The drug diffuses very poorly in agar, compromises discs or e-tests. It's poorly reproducible if you do it in broth. I think it might adhere to the glass or the plastic, and it's not been evaluated with automated systems. And you know, in contrast to the other, we have no molecular target PCR gold standard to say that something is colistin resistant. So time kill methodology has been proposed as the gold standard. And that's because colistin is not actually, is not reliably bactericidal. Initially it is, but usually you get regrowth of the organism if you run it in a time kill, and you get this out at the end, which is clearly completely resistant to colistin. So we have the phenomenon of heteroresistance to colistin. That was in Acinetobacter, but it seems to be in a diverse range of species, Klebsiella, Pseudomonas, Enterobacters, and that's defined by the group in Australia that say a subpopulation of bacteria recovered from the growth of a susceptible strain at above the breakpoint, so 2 milligram per liter. So we looked at all of these things. How should we do it? We looked at broth methods, e-test, agar dilution, and a time kill, which one of our SPRs did, and I don't think she realized that she had to do 30 time kills on this. When she realized that, she was not so keen to do this. And if you could take the time kill as the gold standard, then you can call nearly all of them resistant. The solid media underestimates it, the liquid media reasonable. If you use e-test, if you read, the manufacturer's telling you to read here at this point, at the bottom of the ellipse, but if you read here, where it sort of bows in, then you get a bit more correlation with what you get in broth media. Okay, so does colistin work? Enough trouble with trying to make sure, see if anything is susceptible, does it work? So this is data that we did when we had, we looked at Acinetobacter bacteremia study, and we were looking at, we had a lot of carbapenem-resistant ones, and we wanted to see if colistin was useful in these patients. So if you had a carbapenem-resistant Acinetobacter just susceptible to colistin, you had a worse outcome, you're more likely to die. But if we gave them so-called appropriate treatment with colistin, then there was no impact on the mortality. So this didn't work. And I go back here to the dosing again. And what was given was 1 million units, 8 hourly. And it's another study. This is done in KPC, I think, mostly in Enterobacteriaceae, that this is comparing colistin to beta-lactams or carbapenems, I think. And again, it performs very poorly against the comparative drug to which the organism is susceptible to. Then is colistin safe? Okay, so this is an old drug, and there are concerns that this might not be a safe drug. We have nephrotoxicity and neurotoxicity reported in a lot of older studies with colistin. It seems that this might not be as bad as it was when it was used in the 60s and 70s. But clearly, the more you give of it, then the more likely you are to get nephrotoxicity. The more the cumulative dose, the more likely you will get this. So how should we give it? This is if you look in the BNF or you look in the pack insert for colistin methane sulfate, which is a prodrug, which is metabolized to colistin, then you are supposed to give 1 to 2 million units 8 hourly, which is what we gave in the study when we used it for treating Acinetobacter. And I think this is completely almost homeopathic, because now we have some pharmacokinetic studies that show if we want to get anywhere near like the above the breakpoint, you need to give, even if you give 3 million units 8 hourly, it's going to take you days to get up to a level that might be above the MIC of the organism you're trying to treat. And what this graph shows is the need for a very large loading dose initially to give you therapeutic levels of colistin, and thankfully this has been put into an algorithm which you can if you try and read this paper, it's so complicated to understand the equations they've used to tell you how to do this, but it's summarized here. You need to give a loading dose and then a maintenance dose, which is calculated depending whether on the renal replacement, having a dialysis or whatever. And this seems to be a more rational way to use colistin than just giving 1 million units or 2 million units 8 hourly. Okay, now we come to the hardest things to treat, things which are resistant to colistin or to everything. So how do we treat them? Well, then we have to go to using cocktails of drugs, really. And there are loads of studies that show that there is much, you can get synergy with colistin and with beta-lactams and with tetracyclines, etc. And this is all you can really do if there is nothing that's active. There are a few in vivo studies and there are a few case reports. I would think this is a recent study that shows KBC, which is in Klebsiella, that using a combination is much more effective than using a monotherapy. And the best treatment here seemed to be colistin with tigecycline or colistin with carbapenems. If you're going to use combinations, it would be good to know if they're actually going to be active and have some kind of test to show that they might be. So there are lots of methods you can use to do this. Checkerboards, e-tests, time kills. And the standard way is to define the synergy because you have the fractional inhibitory concentration index less than 0.5. I would say that that's not a great parameter, and it's better to relate the magnitude of the effect you're seeing with the two drugs to the breakpoint, which is known as the susceptible breakpoint index. And if you have that's greater than 2, then you have clinically relevant synergy. So we've looked at synergy. We've looked at colistin combined with glycopeptides because this, to me, really does look like synergy. This is against an acinetobacter. You have no activity of vancomycin at all. You put a tiny bit of colistin in the plate, then you get an enormous crash in the MIC, and it looks like it might be giving useful synergy. And if you run that in a time kill, remember I said that colistin is not cidal. Again, you can see here, it regrows in a time kill. You put glycopeptide in with it as well, you get complete... you get a good 3-log kill, and it's effective with other glycopeptides. Use ticoplanin, telavancin, daptomycin, but it's very species dependent. And it works in. We can't afford to use animals to check these things out, so we just use caterpillars, and we can infect caterpillars with the acinetobacter or carbapenems producer, and treat them with the combination we want to look at, and it virtually mirrors the time kill assay. So, a couple more slides. How should we use colistin combinations? And I'll give you a case. This is a man who had, they came to ITU with renal failure following a failed prostatic resection, and he then developed obstructive nephropathy and became dialysis dependent. He stayed in the ICU for 44 days. He went through multiple courses of antibiotics, beta-lactams, carbapenems, and by day 27, he was colonized with multi-drug resistant acinetobacter. He was discharged with various bits of plastic in his urinary tract, in his ureters, and a prostatic mimeocalcin, and the urine continually cultured acinetobacter. This went on for nearly 2 years, so he continually has this chronic now acinetobacter urinary tract infection. They changed the plastic, the memocath, several times, and they gave 1 million units of colistin prophylactically. And then he becomes dialysis dependent and continually isolate acinetobacter from his urine. So we thought, can we do anything to try and, that's the antibiogram, okay, it's resistant to everything, called susceptible to colistin, by automated method. So we thought, can we do anything the next time they come to take out and change this plastic in his ureter? So we thought, okay, let's see. Is it really sensitive to colistin still, the isolate? So this is what we got. I don't know if it's sensitive to colistin at all. We use an automated method. It's MIC is greater than 4, ETS 0.38, in broth 16. But we decide to use a colistin glycopeptide combination therapy. And we check out the, first of all, we see which is going to be best. We run a checkerboard on it, and colistin tigoplanin looks to be the best. And then we have to devise a dosing regimen based on that Goronczyk protocol that involves a loading dose, maintenance doses, with and without the dialysis. So I just illustrate this is a very complicated thing to sort of set up, and it took a lot of work to try and do this. We then saw what levels we got in him, So we've got reasonable colistin levels in him. These are troughs of, 1.3 to 3.1. Tachyplenin levels were okay. And then we took the isolate and ran the time heel on it. And at using the midpoint concentrations, 2 and 20 of tachyplenin. And clearly colistin was no good against his isolate. We just about got some, useful difference between with the colistin combined with tachyplenin, but more importantly, his urine is now negative. We've been sampling it every 2 weeks, and it's been negative for 3 weeks. Obviously, it's a complicated issue, and removing the plastic wear and all of this is important. But I just illustrate how complicated it can be to do this, to set up with the laboratory information, the clinicians, and the surgeons. Okay, so I think I'm almost done. I just say, is there anything new coming to treat gram-negative resistant gram-negative infections, or are we just relying on colistin forever? Well, it's not. There are a few things on the horizon, I think. So people are still interested in inhibitors. So this one, avibactam from AstraZeneca, previously NXL-104, and one from Merck. I don't know what they're going to combine them with, probably carbapenems. I don't know, maybe cephalosporins with avibactam, aztreonam. Sideriform monobactams, these are so-called Trojan horses, because they subvert the efflux and the porin lesions that stop the agents being taken up, or efflux, because they're complex to siderophores, which are then taken up through the ion acquisition pathway of the bacterium. And there's one from Basilea, BAL-372, and one from Pfizer. I don't know what they could combine them with, maybe meropenem, I don't know. There are some new aminoglycosides, so-called next-generation aminoglycosides, plasmamycin, this company, Achaogen, but they're just new aminoglycosides. They're not resistant to the 16S methylases that are prevalent in many carbapenemase producers. Some next-generation polymyxins, some new colistins that are engineered to be less toxic, but then probably less effective. And this one, NAB-739 from Northern Antibiotics. And then a completely different approach, anti-virulence drugs, really, LPX inhibitors. These are drugs which inhibit the biosynthesis of LPS and make the organism then avirulent, if you like. So LPX-C1 from Pfizer. And I don't know how these may or may not be used, but I guess they'll probably be used in combination with other things. So, if I just summarize, how do we treat these things and what do I do? This is what I do. Cephalosporin-resistant and ESBL producers, severe infections, I use carbapenems, but I think there still is a role maybe for the inhibitors or temocillin. Non-severe infections are based on the antibiogram, UTIs, nitrofurantoin, trimethoprim, if they're sensitive. Carbapenem-resistant gram-negatives, aminoglycosides, perhaps if they're susceptible, colistin, correctly dosed, maybe with rifampicin or with glycopeptides, or high-dose carbapenems with colistin. And for the extreme organisms where we have really nothing to base ourselves on, then I'm afraid it's just cocktails based on the MIC and whatever we can see in vitro synergy, and things like colistin with rifampicin, carbapenems, tigecycline, glycopeptides. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. That's fine. So, questions from the floor. Have we got any? None at the moment. One sort of common scenario one finds oneself in is an Acinetobacter baumannii that's sensitive to colistin and maybe intermediate or even sensitive to tigecycline. What about that combination? Anecdotally, I've used it a few times and not seen the emergence of resistance. Okay. The idea being, my logic being that the TIGI will knock off...
Colistin combined with tigecycline, there is good evidence that there is synergy in vitro, but there's also antagonism at low concentrations, which is quite intriguing. But I think that combination could be used, yes. Okay. And there's good evidence, I'm not going to say it's Acinetobacter, but for KPCs, then from that study from the US suggests that colistin with tigecycline was a useful.
That comes back to the issue of tigecycline having initially been pitched at too low a dose.
Double
the dose.
Yes. Yes.
I never said that. Questions from the floor? No? No questions for David.
Well, just while we're talking of higher doses, the MICs of temacillin, mm-hmm. for strains with KPC, typically are just out of range. They're usually 16s and 32s, whereas a breakpoint 8. Is there scope to go to higher dosage of temacillin? Could it be dosed as ticacillin used to be? These are related compounds. Would temacillin plus gentamicin, to which ST258 is normally susceptible, be a potential combination?
It sounds like a good idea, David, and I think that the study that we do have on clinical outcomes with using temacillin showed that a higher dose was much more effective, 2 grams 12 hourly. So, I make the case for giving as much as you can of any agent that you're going to use without getting into toxicity issues.
I certainly think it needs to be explored at much higher doses. Ticacillin used to be given, I think it was 18 grams a day in total.
It was indeed, yes, old enough to remember that. Okay, I think in the interest of time, you can catch David afterwards. Thank you, David, for an excellent presentation.
Well, in that case...